This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I just want to say, for me personally, what a pleasure it is to introduce an old friend, Jane Mayer, here at Politics and Prose tonight. Jane and I actually first met, she might kill me for saying how long ago it was, but it was a few decades ago when we were just starting out in graduate school. And I don't think at the time back then we probably could have imagined that now almost 40 years later we'd be intersecting in quite the ways that we are now. So at least on my end, I consider it tremendous good fortune that she's only had one career. This is my third. But anyway, in my third career, I'm working at a bookstore that is sponsoring a discussion tonight with not only an old friend, but an old friend who happens to be one of the most accomplished, most respected, and most intrepid journalists of our time. Tonight, as you know, Jane will talk about her latest book. It's called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. For those of you who, and there are probably only few of you, but for those few of you who probably don't know much about Jane's background, she cut her teeth at the Wall Street Journal. She was the paper's first woman White House correspondent and also covered the Middle East and the fall of communism in Europe. In 1995, she joined The New Yorker, and she began the sort of in-depth journalistic work that has become her trademark. She's often referred to as an investigative reporter. And I was thinking about that today, and I realized that title doesn't fully capture the scope and impact of her reporting and writing. Because as we've seen over now more than 20 years, Jane takes on the most impenetrable, vexing, and frankly, most important issues of the day. And then she always seems to manage to produce a best-selling book that offers explanations and answers that the public needs to know. I once heard Jane say that she thinks of her job as uncovering deception, be it the way the government balances national security and individual rights. Think torture, drones, internal whistleblowing. She's also written about the hidden forces that dictate presidencies and the nominations of Supreme Court justices. Needless to say, these are stories that require a reporter who can pose smart questions, dig deeply and relentlessly, and remain undeterred when confronted by powerful interests interested in hiding the truth. In Dark Money, Jane offers the first comprehensive exploration of how right-wing billionaires, most notably David and Charles Koch, have systematically, some might say brilliantly, and certainly ruthlessly, have infiltrated and influenced the major centers of power in America. Political institutions, academic institutions, judicial institutions, along with think tanks and foundations, and in so doing have delivered enormous unchecked power to the radical right, not to mention enormous benefits to their own bottom lines. It took 5 years of first-rate reporting to get to the bottom of this story. And make no mistake, it took guts. What an extraordinary contribution Jane has made to our public consciousness about the dark money that is tainting our political process, our civic life, and our democratic values. So I just want to say, first of all, congratulations. And most of all, thank you. It's a tremendous accomplishment. And a tremendous service to all of us. And I think the impact of her work is reflected and revealed in the size of this crowd here tonight. In conversation with Jane, another very distinguished journalist, James Bennett, is the president and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. He has a illustrious career of his own. We are really delighted, James, that you are with us and that you're going to be leading the conversation with Jane. So welcome to you as well. Please join me in a round of applause for our guest.
Thanks, Lissa. Can you all hear me? Is this coming across? Okay. Thank you, everybody, for turning out for Jane this evening. It's wonderful to hear her talk about this deeply reported and powerfully written book. I thought Jane, a starting point might be, I was kind of thinking people coming cold to this book might think it's mostly about the moment we find ourselves at now and the relatively recent history since Citizens United of Money and Politics, but in fact the subtitle is a hidden history, and it's a much richer story than that. Your field of vision is much deeper than that. And I thought to begin, I might ask you a little bit about how we got here which would create a foundation for maybe some of the questions from me and others over the course of the evening. It is you're looking back over slightly longer period of time since you and Lissa first met. It's a four or five decades. And maybe you could just begin at the beginning and tell us about how it's a story of how a group of interests came together and really did methodically and systematically plan to shift the playing field of American politics over the course of a long period of time. Anybody who thinks that American business has only very short time horizons and only thinks about the next quarter will find themselves reassured by this book because it played a very long game. But and maybe the place to start is with the Lewis Powell memo in 1971 and the reaction that was taking place really in that community to what were seen as the excesses really of the 60s and the direction of the country.
Can everybody hear? Is this okay? Okay. All right. Thanks, James. I definitely want to answer that. First, I just wanted to thank Lissa and Brad, too, for this incredible bookstore. I just wanted to say that first time I spoke here, I had a problem with a babysitter who canceled at the last moment, and I had a baby on my hip as I talked about a book in 1994. She's graduating from college this weekend. So, and this is more than just a bookstore. I feel like it's our town hall, and I'm very honored to be here, and I think you've run it wonderfully. So, yes, I remember when I told my editor, you know, I really think this is a hidden history. He said, that's it. We're going to call the title The Hidden History. And it is, in some ways, it's not surprising that it's the decades that, you know, that go back to when I came to Washington. It starts a little bit earlier to work for the Wall Street Journal covering Reagan. But in the 70s, other than Watergate, I wasn't aware, maybe because I was a student, that there was that much going on politically. It seemed like disco and all the big stuff had happened in the 60s. But there was actually a brewing counter-establishment movement that was very intense and not visible, I think, to most people following politics. And as you say, in 1971, Lewis Powell, the future Supreme Court Justice, gave voice to this movement in a memo that he wrote, and it described what he thought was a cataclysmic turn of events. He was a lawyer for big tobacco companies, and he thought corporate America was under assault and America was taking a wrong direction. And he said, "The enemy is not the kids out in the streets who are in the anti-war movement. It's not the hippies or the yippies. The enemy are the professors. They are the preachers in the pulpits. They're the judges on the benches. They're the scientists. And they're the public opinion makers. It's the opinion elite that we have to change. And we're going to have to, we're not going to be able to change America's opinion until we change these people's opinions. And we're not going to change them, so we'll have to create our own." So they started to, and when he was speaking about this, he wrote a memo that became public accidentally, but he'd already joined a tiny little cell group, which was a private social club with Richard Mellon Scaife. Scaife was the heir to the Gulf Oil fortune. He was worth just unfathomable hundreds of millions of dollars during that point. He had a very strange upbringing, which is described in this book, and I love the families in this book. But he had come into all this money, and he didn't really know what to do with it. And meanwhile, his friend Powell had a lot of ideas about what needed to be done, but no money to do anything with it. The two of them linked up, and they formed the Club to Save Carthage. And they basically thought, we're going to save America from these awful forces, and they began to fund a counter movement, much of it in secret, much of it through philanthropy.
Well, and continue the story actually, because it is interesting. Either it's an irony or a justice, depending on your point of view, I guess, that they seized on the tax code itself, which they were interested in bringing down, to enable the movement that they were trying to create.
It was incredible. I mean, because so what happened is, Scaife, created private family foundations that were created as tax dodges for the most part, so that because any contributions to them became tax deductible, and used those foundations to basically fund a political movement that now I have to say one thing in favor of these people, and even Scaife, who was a very weird and interesting character, but they did understand one thing, which was that ideas have power, and that if you're going to change America, you can't just do it with a bunch of 30-second ads. They looked at the whole structure of how opinion is created in America, and they thought intellectuals mattered, and they funded. At one point, William Simon, who ran one of these foundations, says, we need to fund books, 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 and then some more books. And they start churning out many of the things that have become sort of standards on the right, and funding it. So,
and funding new institutes on college campuses, trying to reach young people, encouraging. I mean, they moved way up the supply chain of ideas and started very early.
Absolutely. I mean, they were, as you said in the introduction, incredibly systematic. So they looked at what would you do? You need think tanks to balance the original think tanks. People think now of Brookings, for instance, as a liberal think tank. It wasn't founded as a liberal think tank. It was founded to be bipartisan and to promote social sciences, but they came in with a very specific political agenda and said, we're going to have our own version, and it's going to come push our own answers to questions. So they came up with, well, AEI was already there, but the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute becomes the Koch's particular one for libertarians, and then judges, the Federalist Society becomes funded. They want to train their own judges, and they talk about, there's one man who's really important named Joyce, who says, kids in school, they're like bottles of wine. They're not worth much when they're new, but as they age, they get more valuable. And we're going to push them up through the system and get a credential them, and they will grow, and the movement will keep moving on and up. And so, I mean, it was quite, and so then they're, so, and then they realized, so the, then I tell the story about the Olin Foundation, another one of these families. They realized they couldn't really make it, they couldn't just break into the universities, which were not right-wing conservative institutions, and they would reject something that was too overt, like an organ transplant. And so instead they developed something they called the beachhead theory, where you would look for one slightly conservative professor and start working with him or her and fund that person, grow the program around them, and then keep funding it from the inside. And they did it. They realized that small colleges were not prestigious, and it wouldn't really matter if they put money into those. So they aimed for the Ivy Leagues. And Olin, you will notice if you are in an Ivy League school at any point, there are Olin chairs everywhere, in every Ivy League, especially even the greats. So,
I'd love to hear you talk a little more about the actual ideology. They were out to win a battle of ideas, really, with ideas that were not remotely in the American mainstream when they started. So their ambitions were really high. And maybe you could talk about it with reference. The book is written in part through the story of several remarkable families. Happy families are all like unhappy families, and they're all unhappy.
There's some unhappy families in this crowd. They have a lot of money, but
extraordinary.
They're not.
But maybe with reference to the Koch family, where their ideas came from
Kochs,
and what they were.
Right. So the Kochs are really an amazing story to their own. And so they were so far right. I think this is something people don't think about today, because you think of Koch Industries, now that everybody's familiar with it. It used to be quite a secret company. But it's a huge private American company, the second largest private company in America. And it's selling products that everybody, I'm sure, in this room uses. Lycra, Stainmaster carpet, Dixie cups, Vanity Fair napkins, you name it. It's everywhere. And yet the family that founded it were so deeply far right that they were almost off the you know, the cliff in America. So you've got the father, Fred Koch, who was a very bright man who figured out a way to refine oil in a better way than others had. But he couldn't do it in America because the major oil companies were keeping him out. So he first went to Russia, Soviet Union, and he built the oil refineries for Stalin. Then, having done that, he went to Germany, where in 1934 and 1935, he designed and helped build the third largest refinery for Hitler. And it was a refinery that could refine high-octane fuel key to the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. And these experiences, apparently, when he came back to Wichita, Kansas, where he was living, he brought back a lot of guilt, particularly about Stalin. And so he became one of the founding members of the John Birch Society, just virulently anti-communist. He thought there were...
He actually had some friends who'd been...
Who'd been killed by Stalin. He's some engineers he knew. And so he... But what was interesting to me was he took some of that anti-communist fervor, which you can understand where he got it from, for sure, and applied it in some ways to the state in America. And he saw anything that reeked of big government as, you know, the beginning of Stalinism back in the U.S. And the boys, who we think of as the Koch brothers, were raised in this atmosphere of complete suspicion and you know, opposition to the United States government doing, you know, interfering in any way. So you asked what they believed. They were very anti-government. They looked at taxes as theft. They regarded government regulations on business as inappropriate and illegal. And Charles actually became trustee at a school called the Freedom School that was so anti-government, the FBI was looking at it as an anarchist threat. And he appears, I found this old newspaper story in the New York Times, Charles appears at the story about the Freedom School, where they're talking about scrapping the Constitution because they don't think there should be a provision for taxes. And he's the proudest graduate of the school. He's at MIT, and he's decided to get another degree. He had a nuclear engineering degree, but he thought that meant you'd have to work with the government. So he's going to go back and get one from chemical engineering. So this is the mindset from which this movement begins.
There are actually four Koch brothers.
There are four. You never hear about the other two.
Do you want to give us a little sketch of the generation of the family?
Four brothers. They broke into two teams who despised each other. So, and they spent 20 years litigating against each other, even employing private eyes to literally go through each other's garbage as they fought over the family fortune and control of the family company. Each one of the boys inherited several hundred million dollars. So it wasn't as if they were living hand to mouth as it was, but they nonetheless fought, and the dominant brother was the second to oldest, Charles, who's always been the leader in the family. He was handsome, athletic, and incredibly competitive and controlling. But he had one older brother who the other three all ganged up on at one point because they accused him of being gay. And the older brother, they set up a secret meeting where they told the older brother it was a business meeting. He walked in. The three others were lined up in chairs across from him. This is according to a sealed deposition that never became public. They're sitting across from him, and they tell him, if you don't hand over your shares to us, we're going to tell Dad you're gay. Charles had been gathering some information about the brother who he thought was gay. He'd gotten the maitre d' or whatever, the concierge at this brother's apartment to let him into the guy's apartment when he wasn't there, where he could snoop through his things. And so they basically tried to blackmail him for being homosexual. And the older brother, whose name is Fred, stood up, said, I'm not going to listen to any more of this, walked out of the room. And that was the end of that. But it was indicative, I think, of the amount of sort of ruthless competition in the family. It was a very unhappy family. And I found part of my reporting is based on there was a secret history commissioned of the family by one brother, Bill, who's the other one you don't hear about. He detested Charles, so he commissioned a historian to do what he a history that's called stealth, the stealth history of Charles Koch, and it is his own brother's, you know, delving into politics and how it happened, and it's quite amazing. It's several hundred pages long, and the historian that he hired was one that Koch Industries had just hired a couple of years before to do the company history. So the historian had access to all of the family papers and quite a few other things. So,
so bring us forward then. Through the 80s and the 90s, how did this infrastructure grow, and what was its impact on politics?
Well, so, okay, in 1980, Charles, who was no longer the trustee of this crazy school, the Freedom School, decided that that he would launch a movement, and he was going to he modeled it on the John Birch Society, which he'd been a member of. He copied the secrecy of the John Birch Society, and he decided that that they would try running for office. His brother was going to be vice president on the Libertarian ticket, and he ran for office, was, of course, defeated. But it gives you an indication of how far right they were. They were running against Reagan from the right because they thought Reagan was a sellout and too liberal. So once they were defeated and realized that at the ballot box their ideas were not going to win in this sort of old-fashioned democratic way, they went back to the drawing board and they studied. There was an aide to them who wrote a paper on how you manufacture political change in America. And they were engineers, and they studied the whole American political system, and they figured out that you could do a sort of an assembly line. It would take the creation of intellectuals who would push your point of view. You subsidize them. Then think tanks who would take what they called the raw product, which were ideas, and turn them into marketable products, which were policy papers. And then you would create front groups of grassroots-seeming people on the streets who would militate for these policies to be implemented. And then you would push for candidates who would turn them into laws. So they basically looked at all the widgets of American policy and politics and started to create a machine that would suit their purposes. And they did. I mean, I think if there's anything I'd like people to understand is this isn't just about elections. They've won some elections, they've lost some elections, but what they've been aiming at is something much more ambitious, which is about changing the conversation in America and the way people think. And so that if you can turn Americans, for instance, against government and make the government seem dysfunctional, that's a real win for them. So,
yeah, there's actually it undermines anybody's a little bit anybody's concern that there's a conspiracy here to read your chapter on the 2012 election and how this conservative network of fundraisers at the time basically formed, at least in the primaries, a kind of circular firing squad and began taking out one another's candidates.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking about Sheldon Adelson funding Newt Gingrich, who then went after Mitt Romney as a terrible, you know, heartless capitalist, and somewhat, you know, putting him in conflict with the message others were seeking to.
Well, this is the problem when you get too many billionaires in one room at the same time. A friend of mine calls this the Koch's magic trick, though, which is they are obviously very rich in their own right. They're each worth $45 billion now. So.
They've done really well under Barack Obama.
They've done incredibly well. They started each with $14 billion, and they're now at $45 billion. So compare that to your portfolio. I don't know. But at any rate, what the magic trick is, they aren't just putting money into this themselves. They've gathered around them a group, which they call the network, and they call the members of it the investors. And they won't reveal the names of the investors, but every now and then a guest list slips out, and we get to see a few things about who's part of it. But the problem with all the investors, the good thing for them is it creates this tremendous incredibly powerful kitty, which they're talking about now of spending $889 million in the 2016 election cycle. That's the upside. The downside is not all the investors agree. They agree with the Kochs. The glue that holds everything together is they want to keep their taxes down and keep the regulations off their businesses. And they're all anti-labor, but organized labor. But other than that, you know, they disagree on things like foreign policy, neoconservatives versus libertarians, and plenty of other things. And so they wind up kind of canceling each other out a little bit in 2012.
You mentioned there being anti-labor. I mean, from their perspective, there is an entire infrastructure on the other side, right? That they're that
and
they
labor
feel
is what they mostly
and attack. It's the unions. It is the liberal professors entrenched in college campuses. There's the intellectual infrastructure that did predate them, and then there are the liberal billionaires on the other side as well, right?
Right. You know? You can't talk about this subject without somebody saying in about the first sentence, George Soros, yeah. Who I also wrote about, to be fair, when in 2004 he was pouring money into politics in a big way, I profiled him as well. You know, what you get, though, that it's interesting, even if you just take the billionaires on both sides rather than canceling each other out completely, there have been a lot of studies that show that very wealthy people have different interests from people who don't have any money. And I was thinking George Soros when I profiled him, he's not a big fan of organized labor. And none of them that I know, or very few of them, are really pushing to get rid of, to raise taxes on capital gains, for instance. And so what you see is there have been, for instance, there's a professor at Princeton, Gillens, who did a study saying that the interests of ordinary voters in things like strengthening Social Security have so little impact in Congress compared to the interests of the billionaires of both sides. But I would just say the book is called Dark Money, and it focuses mostly on secret funding. And in the dark money department in 2014, 80% of it was on the right, and 20% of it was on the liberal side. So it's not, there's not really an equal playing field, and it would be, there's an urge among journalists to try to say, on the one hand, on the other hand, so that nobody attacks you. But truthfully, it's misleading to say they're exactly alike, because they're not.
Although it is, and I'll open it up to you guys in just a second, if people want to, I guess we've got microphones on either side, and if people want to start lining up, I'll stop monopolizing the questions. But it is interesting, the observation you just made, that in a sense, this is, it transcends left and right, and this is kind of a chilling note you end on, I think, in the book, that it's class in the end, and an alliance potentially of billionaires who are trying to preserve their prerogatives.
Well, I really think that's the worry, and that's why it matters so much. There are individual policies that matter a lot, where you can see that Congress has been captured by private interests, for instance, on global warming. I mean, why is the U.S. Congress going the opposite direction of science and the rest of the world? Well, it's not hard to see why if you look at the money. But more than that, I think I do really worry that and it's not just me. I've interviewed so many experts who, even including Republican experts, people are worried that the idea that you could have growing economic inequality coinciding with political equality is in tension. And that there's a problem that when you've got so much money in so few hands, and that the contributions in politics are so skewed, that you're going to see the democracy get distorted. And that is a big worry.
Let's go to you guys. May I ask you to please ask your question in the form of a question and preserve as much time for Jane to give her answers so we can get through as many questions as possible. Please go ahead.
Okay. So I was born in 1947. I graduated from college in 1969. I watched as this transformation happened. You haven't mentioned race. And that was a big that was one way that the Republicans and the conservative Republicans were able to swing the South, for instance. Did these billionaires Did they worry about race, or was that something that was introduced by the politicians looking for votes in the South?
The father, Koch, Fred, wrote a pamphlet in which he talked about how welfare is a plot to bring blacks into the cities where they will take on the white people. He was in the John Birch Society, which, of course, tried to impeach Earl Warren for Brown versus the Board of Education. So there is certainly a racial element. And the thing that changed a lot for the Koch's network was Obama's election. There had been a lot of interest some interest in libertarianism and the far right before Obama was elected. After he was elected, this group was mobbed with people who wanted to join up. There was so much more fear. And I don't know if it's racial, but you can just see that. I mean, I interviewed people who said suddenly that even the Kochs didn't know what to do because there were so many people who wanted to join forces with them. So,
interesting.
Hi, I worked as a lobbyist for about 27 years on justice issues, and I was interested when the Koch people were involved in setting up this coalition for public safety. My first impression was, why are they at the table? What do they know about criminal justice? I mean, just having money, is that how they get a seat at the table, along with the ACLU and other groups?
Well, they've been defendants. The Kochs have a long history of being being prosecuted. No, but it's actually true. It is, and they've been quite open in saying, when I interviewed their general counsel about this, what brought them to the table was they felt they were wrongly prosecuted in one of the major pollution cases that the Justice Department brought against them. So they felt picked on, there's also in the Venn diagram of American politics a little overlap between libertarians and liberals on the subject of criminal justice, because the Kochs dislike the state. And they, since if you go back to 1980, Charles Koch has been saying, get rid of the Justice Department, get rid of the EPA. So there is a little bit of overlap.
Well, one example, if I could. They seem to focus on prison populations.
That's where the action is right now.
They're going to try to lower
nonviolent
prison
drug offenders, right.
But they never mention the jail. Like the Vera Institute of Justice found that if you look at prison and jail populations, and they use it interchangeably, they assume the jail is the same as the prison, even though the prison is run by the state and the jail is run by local government or county government.
Yeah.
They actually favor privatized jails for the most part, from what I can see. They've been what I left out was they've had been very involved in state-level politics. There's a state think tank in every state now that's partly funded by the same families.
But
we need to move on.
Throw out one fact. The Vera Institute found that over a year period, there are 18 times the number of people going to jail as going to prison, and yet they ignore that altogether.
Do they? It is consistent with the libertarian philosophy to be really concerned about incarceration rates. There's consistency in their thinking there. Are they worried about the drug laws? Is that part of
the... Yeah, I mean, there are... Charles Koch has also been in favor of legalizing most drugs since the 70s. I mean, the libertarians had a sort of a hippie streak, but it was for coming from a different direction, really.
And despite history you told earlier, David, at least, is his libertarian philosophy also extends to gay rights, right? I mean,
it may now. It didn't when they were locking their brother in a room and trying to...
I'm just wondering if they've changed or what's changed.
I think the country has changed so much on gay rights that they've probably... that they reflect the change in other places. But I will say, I think they get off easy when David has given an interview or two saying that he supports gay rights, maybe to Barbara Walters. Okay, that's great, but they put no money behind it. What are they putting their money behind? Not gay rights, and not that much behind criminal justice reform either. They're putting their money behind getting rid of regulations and lowering taxes.
You've started to answer my question, which is tell us about the charm offensive. Because David, for example, gave a full one-page interview in the Financial Times. They met in his lunchroom, and they had $2 lunches, and they told him all about how he was interested in the things you just mentioned. Plus, I mean, he sounded like just a nice, sweet, middle-of-the-road fella who might be a little bit to the right of normal people.
Yeah, that was actually Charles, and the $2 lunch, I think, tells
Charles?
You. It was Charles, and you know, the funny thing, having spent so much time writing about these families that have just unfathomable amounts of money, a lot of them are pretty cheap, and they care about money. They're watching their money. But at any rate, there is a charm offensive. I did a piece in The New Yorker recently. It was about the new Coke, and it was about how they have – what happened was after 2012, they and their organization, their other donors, had put tons of money into Mitt Romney, and they were shocked when he didn't win. They thought up until the day – into the afternoon of the election that they were going to win. And so they are very smart about trying to learn from failure. And they went back and they did a lot of research. They did a huge amount of focus grouping and went through 170,000 polls. And they came to the conclusion that if they want to win over the middle of America, they already have the right – and they're never going to get the left. But if they want that middle third, as they call it, they've got to be seen to be compassionate, because people they discovered thought that they were greedy. And so, seriously, the reason I know this is there's a tape that leaked out of a conversation where they're talking about all of this, and it you couldn't really make it up. And so they discuss what they need to do, and one of the things they talk about is how they need to form improbable alliances with people that wouldn't be expected. They then give a lot of money to the United Negro College Fund. They step up this role in criminal justice where they start not just pushing for white-collar reform, but for indigent defense, things that are really issues for poorer Americans. And they start describing their libertarian philosophy in completely new terms. And what they've done is they've done research that shows them if you call it a movement for well-being, people will feel more kindly towards it. So Charles Koch started something called the Well-Being Institute, and he has started having seminars on the subject of well-being, and in the end of the day, usually there's someone on a panel who says, well, free enterprise is what makes me feel good. And it is a big charm offensive. I was interviewing them about it. They're spending $15 million on corporate advertising for the first time. So.
Yes, sir.
As far as I know, there's no individual or institution that doesn't have vulnerabilities. And so if everyone in this room and like-minded people, assuming most of the people in this room are of some like mind, and they want to challenge the power of what you're describing, what are points of vulnerability of the individuals and the institutions with which they network that would be strategic points to challenge in challenging their power?
Well, I think if you press down on the rhetoric of the free market, you'll find, for instance, that Koch Industries benefits from a tremendous number of government subsidies, tax deals of various sorts. It's hypocritical if you really press down on it. And there is, you know, there is no such — the free market is a utopian idea, but we all work with rules that are made by the people we elect. I think another area that to me is a vulnerability is just what kind of accountability there should be for people who are unelected but playing such a big role in politics. I mean, I think they are. I think it's an uncomfortable concept for most Americans that 400 or 500 of the richest people in the country would be gathering their fortunes together to try to pick the next leader, because it's a democracy. And I think that that's a, that is just that idea of that is something that people are very uncomfortable with.
But is you, your starting point was that it is a battle of ideas. And do you feel like their ideas have actually gotten traction with the public?
I think so. I think when the public is focused on issues like the deficit, but not on or on and decides that when the politicians define Social Security as needing to be reduced or shredded or privatized rather than strengthened in some way, these are all issues where they've had a great impact, I think, on social safety net issues. That would be one area.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I know from my own research on the internet, marriage equality has always been an issue of great passion for me pretty since the moment I became political. And I know that's part of the reason why the National Organization for Marriage still exists despite its repeated and unbroken list of failures, is that every year for the last decade or so, it has gotten the majority of its money from anonymous wealthy donors who give, you know, $1.5 million, $2.5 million at a time, depending on the month or year. When you were doing your research on these right-wing billionaires with their dark money, to what extent do they intersect with the more theocratic impulses in our society?
Well, the Kochs are not particularly religious. Some of the others in their group really are. So the DeVos family of Michigan, which started the Amway company, is they're very big players in all of this. And they've been very religious and on the right. So, again, it's a coalition of people who don't agree on every single issue. So, but just to, James, just to go back to your question about the impact of this group, there was a study that just came out about 2 weeks ago from Harvard, and what its point was by Theda Skocpol, who's a government professor there, the point was it's called the Koch effect. And what it says is this small group of people has pulled the Republican Party in particular so far to the right. It's not and so when you look at the campaign this year, it's almost like two different languages being spoken. And I think that that's a place where you can really see the effect. You've got, you know, the on the economic policies in particular.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a whole separate primary, which is the donor primary, that these guys have to get through.
And every one of the major candidates on the Republican side has gone to beg for money from the Kochs, other than Trump.
You're an investigative journalist, but many of your most sensational assertions come from anonymous sources. Don't you think that those should be better sourced if you want to consider this, you know, hardcore journalism?
What are you thinking of?
Well, I mean, just now, for instance, you referenced an undisclosed deposition or a...
That's about as sourced as you can get.
Okay.
It's a document that exists in a courtroom that has a date and a stamp on it.
Well, and then otherwise...
What else?
You often cite David Axelrod, who is a Democratic operative.
He's got a name and he speaks for himself.
Yeah, I know.
He's on the record.
I'm aware. I'm just wondering if this is more of journalism or an opinion piece in your opinion.
Well, no, I mean, it's a fair question. Is it a fair book? You know, it's a book that I made as fair as I could. And I went overboard, really, to try to understand these people who wouldn't speak to me. The brothers did not give me an interview. So I spoke to their friends, their childhood friends, their schoolmates, their other family members. I got the hold of the history that one brother did of the other brother. I got court documents. I went through all their speeches. I think it is a very... It's a tough portrait, but I think it's a very true portrait. And I guess part of the reason I think it's true is it's very much builds off of the New Yorker article that I wrote about them. And I've written other things about them. We've never had to run a correction. So.
Thank you.
Sorry, over here.
Do the Koch brothers have money in the militia movement, and is the Treasury Department tracking their money both within the United States and abroad, or are they careful to put it in smaller donations under 20,000 each time so that they won't be detected.
I don't know that they have any money in the militia movement, but Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch's major political sort of grassroots group right now, has been helping some of the Sagebrush Rebellion that is to try to get public lands out of the hands of the government. So, I mean, that's maybe the closest you can see to sort of crossing over to that kind of radical rural movement. They there are unusual aspects to them as libertarians. They're pretty anti-military. They don't like spending money on the military. It's expensive. And there's an old saying among libertarians that war is the health of the state. They think it builds up the government.
How do they feel about the police?
I don't really know. I don't know.
Hi, Jane. Hey. First of all, congratulations to Kate on her graduation.
Thank you. Fellow father from school.
Secondly, if the Koch brothers will go through each other's trash, do you worry that they'll go through yours? And I've heard some talk about you're being investigated. I'll sit down and take your response.
I always felt that I was throwing out stuff that was so boring that I'd feel sorry for anybody who had to go through it. So I didn't worry too much about my trash, but when I did get to the end of drafts of the book, I burned them in the fireplace, I have to say.
And then went out and bought a new computer, I guess.
I did worry about the computer being hacked, I have to say. After the New Yorker piece came out, the Kochs didn't like it. And they... plenty of people don't like pieces. You know, this is not that unusual. Some people do. Every now and then you write something someone likes, and it's so nice. But in this case, they didn't. And I began to hear warnings from people. Somebody called me up out of the blue and said, "How do you feel about having a private eye digging into you?" And I said, "Ha ha ha." You know, I didn't think it was possible. Then I saw somebody at a party who said, "You know, I was asked to work for a private eye who was working for two billionaires who wanted to dig into a reporter whose piece they didn't like about them." And it occurred to me it might be you. And so, again, didn't think about it. But then, because I have a pretty uninteresting life. And then I got a call from David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, saying, "Could you help me with this?" And he'd gotten calls from the Daily Caller, which is a sort of a conservative blog or whatever, website, news site sort of, and from the New York Post. And they were both ready to go with a story the next day. Somehow they both had the same story at the same time that was going to say that I was a plagiarist. And they needed me to... David said, "Could you look at what is this? I don't, you know." He said, "I'm sure it's ridiculous, but could you just take a look at it?" And so, I took a look at the particulars, and there were four instances of sentences in the last 10 years that were like other people's sentences, sort of, or that seemed like some of the same material. The idea or something. And so I looked at it and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. If you're going to steal something, it's not going to be this. But I knew it wasn't right, but I also knew I was going to be ruined by the next morning if I didn't do something about it, because they were going to go with it the next day. And so I got a hold of the writers whose work I was supposed to have pilfered. One of them was a Washington Post reporter who said, "Not only did you not steal from me, you credited me in the next frigging sentence." And then I looked up the thing. Eventually, he told me a couple years later that we had linked to his story online and that my husband had edited it. So, because he was at the Washington Post at the time. So I was stealing from my husband. But anyway, absurd though it sounds, it was scary. And each of the writers was wonderful, stood up, gave an on-the-record statement saying this isn't true. And the Daily Caller and the New York Post decided not to run the pieces because they weren't true. But then the New York Post started running pieces saying, they had a piece called Smear Disappears, and saying, "Who's behind this?" Anyway, it took me 3 years to figure it out. And what was behind it were several of the highest level Koch operatives in Washington who had were working with a private eye in New York who turned out to be the former police commissioner, Howard Safer. And they had dug through my dating years and God knows what. But anyway, this is what they came up with. So,
please.
Those of us who care about education policy felt certainly overwhelmed by right-wing people that come up with rationales for vouchers, for charter schools, for all kinds of things, and certainly very much anti-teachers' unions. And I wondered in your researches if the Koch brothers or others were some of the major players in funding a lot of this research for education policy coming from the right.
Of the foundations I looked at that was most involved in that was the Bradley Foundation. And there's the story of the Bradley Foundation is in the book. They're in Milwaukee, but they really started some of the early voucher programs. And this one family, the DeVos family that we talked about earlier, has been very important in that movement too. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the voucher movement and a lot of it would not exist without a handful of families that have really pushed it hard. So,
Hi, my name's Colin. I'm a student at George Mason University, which you know well. We've been looking into this issue for a few years now and have since formed a group on Koch My Campus. And I'm just curious, somebody was talking about vulnerabilities. And how do you think that the university system really fits into their narrative and how important it is compared to, you know, say their influence in politics and candidates specifically?
I think the university part of their funding is really important, and it's the area where Charles Koch has been ramping up the most recently in recent years. They've now got programs they fund in somewhere between 230 and 307. I've seen different numbers, universities and colleges, and these programs that fund sort of free market thinking. And I you know, when part of the reason I think it's important is, again, that same tape where the Kochs were talking about well-being or where their operatives were, they also talk about what they've built with this university program. And they call it an unparalleled pipeline. And they describe how you take a talented student and you train them and then you place them in what they call our system. And they put them in think tanks in the States or in some of these grassroots groups, and they're really sort of growing up a generation of to think like them. And it's very much really what Charles Koch talked about in 1976 when he wrote a paper saying we need to aim at youth because they're the ones that we can kind of recruit. And so I think it is important. So.
We are almost out of time, but I do want to get to the remaining people who are up at the mic. So with all of your help, we'll get through these last questions, and unfortunately we won't have time beyond that, but we'll take the last four here.
Great.
Are there two or three people there?
Two.
Okay. Four. Great, that's perfect. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, I'm interested in some of the some of what you were saying about people who are working with the Koch brothers, you know, fellow billionaire families, and you know, we talked a little bit about how there are clearly some clashes on you know, religious right versus libertarian right views. But it strikes me do you see evidence of a similar kind of clash when you look at, you know, you talk about how the Koch brothers and some of their close allies really are not so favorable toward military interventionism versus other families and people who obviously are intimately connected to the whole military industrial complex. And, you know, what if, you know, another, you know, George W. Bush type president or another, you know, major years long military intervention? Do you see any signs of, like, fundamental fissures or cracks within this coalition or even inconsistencies?
It's just that they're quite pragmatic about it. They're looking for, they've made alliances with people who agree with them on economic issues, and they're ready to let the other things go, and those people can go in their own direction on that. They're really not purists except on the economic issues, from what I can see.
In the 70s, I was working on drafting the legislation that on campaign financing.
Ah.
And being Democrats, we had chose government bans and limits, which is what Democrats would do. The other alternative was to focus on markets, disclosure. Everybody would know who was buying whom. Mm-hmm. Nothing would be dark. But, of course, being Democrats, we chose limits and bans, all of which are going to be gone. Right about that time, there was the Supreme Court case, in the opticians case, that held the corporations had First Amendment rights, and Buckley versus Vallejo saying speech and money. So the writing was on the wall that if you want to focus on bans and limits and prefer government controls rather than markets, we might have made a terrible bet. And I'm wondering whether the Democrats completely blew it in the 70s by not focusing on markets rather than limits.
You know, I don't know, but I do think that this issue of transparency is what was supposed to happen with Citizens United. So you had Kennedy saying, well, that will be the balance against corruption because everybody with the internet era will instantly see where the money is. The money, of course, is completely dark. It's more and more going through 501c4 groups that are supposed to be social welfare groups.
It's dark because we blew the drafting in the 70s.
Well, I don't know. But it's an interesting point.
Please go ahead.
What about their role in the climate change issue?
It's huge. I mean, this is, if you're looking for places where there is an impact, it is on this issue. And, I mean, I can't go into it all here, but there's a chapter on it. And I think that is, as much as anything, their imprint is why this country's gone in this direction. And they've done a lot.
How did they do it?
Well, they've worked this whole system that they've got of think tanks and everything else. They've created so much confusion. In a 4-year period, $500 million went into think tanks and experts and media dissemination and everything else suggesting that climate change wasn't happening, or if it was, it wasn't man-made, and or that if it was both those things, that any solution to it would be so expensive we can't afford it.
It looks like the 2010 midterms were kind of the pivital moment
where they
Republicans
defeated,
fell in line.
And the Kochs, literally, their organization, Americans for Prosperity, just took out any Republican who was in favor of doing cap and trade. And also very, very, very conservative Democrats. I interviewed some of them in the book. I mean, they were targeted and taken out in primaries, and, you know, so much money was against them that it's kind of stunning to look at it.
But if they train up these brilliant people, don't some of them fall out? Don't they get?
Well, they did actually. It's funny. The Kochs funded a study on global warming. I think it was at Berkeley, and it was a climate skeptic who was doing the work. And the data came back saying climate change is real, and the scientist was honest enough to say this is what the data says, and it was very embarrassing for them because it was their own study.
But. All right. Well, thank you all for your questions. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Jane.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.